4. A squad of eyes was waiting beside the boathouse when the little craft completed its circuit of the artificial river.
"Here,"
said Stragos, after one of his soldiers took the oar from him. He removed two glass vials from his pockets and held one out to each Komori thief.
"Your first stay of execution. The poison's had time to work its way into you. I don't want to have to worry about you for the next few weeks."
Locke and Jean complied, each gagging as they drank.
"Tastes like chalk," said Locke, wiping his mouth.
"If only it were that inexpensive," said the Archon. "Now give the vials back. Caps too."
Locke sighed. "I suppose it was too much to hope you'd forget that part." The two thieves were being hauled back toward the Mon Magisteria as Stragos lashed the boat to the piling once again. Stragos stood up, stretched, and felt the old familiar creaks, the twinges in his hips and knees and wrists. Damn rheumatism. By rights, he was still outrunning his age, still ahead of most men nearing 80 years, but he knew deep in his heart that there would never be any way of running fast enough. Sooner or later, the Lady of the Long Silence would call a dance for Maxillan Stragos, whether or not his work here was done. Meraine was waiting in the shadows of the unlit side of the boathouse, still and quiet as a hunting spider until she stepped out beside him. Long practice enabled him to avoid flinching.
"My thanks for saving those two, Meraine. You've been very useful to me these past few weeks."
"Just as I was instructed to be," she said. "But are you sure they really suit the needs of this plan of yours?"
"They're at every disadvantage in this city, my dear."
Stragos squinted at the blurry forms of Locke, Jean, and their escorts as they disappeared into the garden.
"The Bonds Magi sewed them up for us, and we have them second-guessing their every step. I don't believe those two are used to being controlled. Out on their own, I know they'll perform as required."
"Your reports give you that much confidence?"
"Not merely my reports," said Stragos. "Requin certainly hasn't killed them yet, has he?"
"I suppose not."
"They'll serve," said Stragos. "I know their hearts. As the days go by, the resentment will fade, and the novelty will gain on them. They'll be enjoying themselves soon enough, and when they start to enjoy themselves, I honestly think they can do it. If they live. It's for damn sure I've no other agents suitable to the task."
"Then I may report to my masters that the plan is underway?"
"Yes, I suppose this commits us. You may do just that."
Stragos eyed the shadowed shape of the slender woman beside him and sighed.
"Let them know that everything begins in a month or so. I hope for their sake they're ready for the consequences."
"Nobody's ready for the consequences," said Meraine. "It's going to mean more blood than anyone's seen in 200 years. All we can do is hope that by sitting things off we can ensure that others reap most of the trouble. By your leave, Archon, I'd like to go compose my messages to them now."
"Of course," said Stragos. "Send my regards along with your report, and my prayers that we might continue to prosper together."
Last reminiscence, by their own rope. 1.
"Oh, this is a wonderful spot to fling ourselves to our deaths from," said Locke.
6 months had passed since his return from Salon Corbeau. The suite of 4 exquisitely crafted chairs was safely locked away in a private storage room at the Villa Candessa. Talvarar's version of late winter held the region in the grip of temperatures so brisk that folk had to engage in actual labor to break a sweat. About an hour's hard ride north of Talvarar, just past the village of Vaux Samara and its surrounding fields,
A scrubby forest of gnarled witchwood and amberthorn trees rose beside a wide, rocky vale. The walls of this vale were the greyish colour of corpse flesh, giving the place the look of a giant wound in the earth. The thin, olive-coloured grass abandoned the struggle for life about 10 feet from the edge of the cliffs above this vale, where Locke and Jean stood contemplating the sheer 100-foot drop to the gravel floor far below.
"I suppose we should have kept more in practice with this," said Jean, starting to shrug his way out of the half-dozen coils of rope draped from his right shoulder to his left hip. "But then I don't recall many opportunities to put it to use in the past few years."
"Most places in Camor we could just hand over hand it up and down," said Locke. "I don't think you were even with us that night we used ropes to get up Lady Damar's tower of that horrible old estate of hers. Carlo and Galdo and I nearly got pecked to bloody shreds by pigeons working that one. Must have been 5, 6 years ago."
"Oh, I was with you, remember? On the ground, keeping watch. I saw the bit with the pigeons. Hard to play sentry when you're pissing yourself laughing."
"Wasn't funny at all from up top. Beaky little bastards were vicious."
"The death of 1,000 pecks," said Jean. "You would have been legends, dying so gruesomely. I'd have written a book on the man-eating pigeons of Camor and joined the Therin Collegium. Gone respectable. Barg and I would have built a memorial statue to the Sansas with a nice plaque."
"What about me?"
"Footnote on the plaque, space permitting."
"Hand over some rope or I'll show you the edge of the cliff, space permitting."
Jean tossed a coil to Locke, who plucked it out of the air and walked back toward the edge of the forest, about 30 feet from the cliff. The rope was tightly woven demi-silk, much lighter than hemp and much more expensive. At the rim of the forest, Locke selected a tall old witchwood, about as broad around as Jean's shoulders. He pulled a goodly length of his line free, passed it around the tree trunk, and stared at the slightly frayed end for a few seconds, trying to rekindle his memories of knot tying. As his fingers slipped into hesitant motion, he took a quick glance around at the melancholy state of the world. A stiff wind was blowing from the northwest, and the sky was one vast cataract of wet-looking haze. Their hard carriage was parked at the far end of the woods, perhaps 300 yards away. He and Jean had set the driver up with a clay jug of beer and a splendid basket lunch from the Villa Candessa, promising to be gone for a few hours at most.
"Jean," muttered Locke as the bigger man stepped up beside him, "this is a proper anchor noose, right?"
"Certainly looks like it."
Jean hefted the elaborate knot that secured the rope in a bite around the tree and nodded. He took the working end of the rope and added an additional half-hitch for safety.
"There, just right."
He and Locke worked together for a few minutes, repeating the anchor noose knot with 3 further lengths of rope, until the old witchwood tree seemed thoroughly decorated with taut demi-silk. Their spare coils of rope were set aside. The two men then slipped out of their long frock coats and their vests, revealing heavy leather belts studded with iron rings at their waists. The belts weren't quite like the custom climbing harnesses treasured by the more responsible burglars of Camor. These were actually nautical in origin, used by those happy sailors whose ship owners cared enough to spend a bit of money to preserve their health. The belts had been available on the cheap, and had spared Locke and Jean the need to suss out a contact in Talvarar's underworld who could make a pair to order, but remember the transaction. There were a few things Requin would be better off not knowing until the chance came to finally spring the game on him.
"Right then, here's your descender."
Jean passed Locke a fairly heavy bit of iron, a figure 8 with one side larger than the other, with a thick bar right down the middle. He also kept one for himself. He'd had them knocked up by a blacksmith in Talvarar's Istrian Crescent a few weeks earlier.
"Let's get you rigged up first. Mainline, then belay."
Locke clipped his descender into one of his harness rings and threaded it through with one of the demi-silk lines leading back to the tree. The other end of this line was left free and tossed toward the cliff. A second line was lashed tight to a harness ring above Locke's opposite hip. Many Camorri thieves on working jobs danced naked without the added safety of a belay line in case their primary rope broke. But for today's practice session, Locke and Jean were in firm agreement that they were going to play it safe and boring. It took a few minutes to rig Jean up in a similar fashion. Soon enough, they were each attached to the tree by two lines, like a pair of human puppets. The two thieves wore little save their tunics, breeches, field boots, and leather gloves, though Jean did pause to slip his reading optics on.
"Now then," he said, "seems a fine day for abseiling. Care to do the honors before we kiss solid earth farewell?"
"Crooked warden," said Locke, "men are stupid. Protect us from ourselves. If you can't, let it be quick and painless."
"Well said." Jean took a deep breath. "Crazy part on three?"
"On three." Each of them took up their coiled main line and tossed the free end over the cliff. The two ropes went over and uncoiled with a soft hiss.
"One," said Locke.
"Two,"
said Jean. "Three," they said together. Then they ran for the cliff and threw themselves off, whooping as they went. For one brief moment, Locke's stomach and the misty grey sky seemed to be turning a somersault in unison. Then his line was taut and the cliff face was rushing toward him just a little too eagerly for his taste. Like a human pendulum, he swung in, raised his legs, and hit the rock wall about 8 feet beneath the rim, keeping his knees bent to absorb the shock of impact. That much, at least, he remembered very well. Jean hit with a heavier whoomp about 2 feet below him.
"He!"
said Locke, his heartbeat pounding in his ears, loud enough to match the whisper of the wind.
"There's got to be an easier way to test whether or not we have an honest rope weaver, Jean."
"Phew!" Jean shifted his feet slightly, keeping a hold on his line with both hands. The use of the descenders made it easy for them to apply enough friction to the rope to slow or stop at will. The little devices were a marked improvement on what they'd been taught as boys. While they could still no doubt slide down a rope using their own bodies for friction, as they once had, it was easy to abrade a certain protruding portion of the male anatomy with that approach if one was careless or unlucky. For a few moments they simply hung there, feet against the cliffside, enjoying their new vantage point as the vaporous clouds rolled by overhead. The ropes waving in the air beneath them only hung down about half the distance to the ground, but they didn't intend to get there today anyway. There would be plenty of time to work up to longer drops in future practice sessions.
"You know," said Locke, "this is the only part of the plan I must admit that I wasn't terribly sure of. It's so much easier to contemplate abseiling from a height like this than it is to actually run off a cliff with just two lengths of rope between you and Azaguia."
"Ropes and cliffs are no problem," said Jean. "What we need to watch out for up here are your carnivorous pigeons."
"I'll bend over and bite your own ass."
"I'm serious. I'm terrified. I'll keep a sharp lookout, lest the last thing we feel in this life should be that terrible swift pecking."
"Jean, your belay line must be weighing you down. Here, let me cut it for you."
They kicked and shoved good-naturedly against one another for a few minutes, Locke scrambling around and trying to use his agility to balance out Jean's far greater strength and mass. Strength and mass seemed to be winning the day, however, so in a fit of self-preservation he suggested they actually practice descending.
"Sure," said Jean. "Let's go down 5 or 6 feet, nice and smooth, and stop on my mark, shall we?"
Each of them gripped his taut main line and released a bit of tension on his descender. Slowly, smoothly, they slipped down a good 2 yards, and Jean cried, "Hold!"
"Not bad," said Locke. "The knack seems to come back quick, doesn't it?"
"I suppose. I was never really keen on this after I got back from my little holiday at Revelation House. This was more your thing and the Sansa's than mine. And, Sabatha's, of course."
"Yeah," said Locke wistfully.
Yeah, she was so mad. So mad and so lovely. I used to love watching her climb. She didn't like ropes. She'd take her boots off and let her hair out and wouldn't even wear gloves sometimes. Just her breeches and her blouse. And I would just sit there hypnotized, said Jean, struck dumb. Hey, my eyes worked back then too, Locke. Heh, I suppose it must have been obvious. Gods. Locke stared at Jean and laughed nervously. Gods, I'm actually bringing her up myself. I don't believe it. His expression turned shrewd. Are we all right with each other, Jean? Back to being comfortable, I mean. Hell, we're hanging together 80 feet above a messy death, aren't we? I don't do that with people I don't like. That's good to hear. And, yeah, I'd say we're...
Gentlemen! Hello down there!
The voice was Ferrari, with a rough, rustic edge. Locke and Jean glanced up in surprise and saw a man standing at the edge of the cliff, arms akimbo, silhouetted against the churning sky. He wore a threadbare cloak with the hood thrown up. Hello up there, said Locke.
Fine day for a bit of sport, ain't it?
That's exactly what we thought, cried Jean.
A fine day indeed, begging your pardon, sirs, and a fine set of coats and vests you've gone and left up here. I like them very much, excepting that there ain't no purses in the pockets.
Of course not, we're not stupid. Hey, come on now, kindly don't mess with our things, said Jean. As if by some unspoken signal, he and Locke reached out to brace themselves against the cliff, finding hand and footholds as quickly as they could.
Why not? They're such fine things, sirs. I just can't help but feel sort of drawn to them, like.
If you'll just wait right there, said Locke, preparing to begin climbing, one of us should be up in a few minutes, and I'm sure we can discuss this civilly.
I'm also sort of drawn to the idea of keeping you two down there, if it's all the same to you, gents.
The man moved slightly, and a hatchet appeared in his right hand.
It's a mighty fine pair of choppers you've left up here with your coats, too. Damned fine. Ain't never seen the like.
That's very polite of you to say, yelled Locke.
Oh, sweet jumping fuck, muttered Jean.
I might point out, however, continued Locke, that our man at the carriage is due to check on us soon, and he'll have his crossbow with him.
Oh, you mean the unconscious fellow I like jacked over the head with a rock, sir? Sorry to report that he was drunk.
I don't believe you. We didn't give him that much beer.
Begging pardon, but he weren't all that much man, gents. Skinny fellow, if you savvy. As it is, he's sleeping now. And he didn't have no crossbow anyway. I checked.
Well, I hope you don't blame us for trying, said Locke.
I don't, not one little bit. Good try. Very creditable-like. But I'm sort of interested, if you don't mind, in the whereabouts of your purses.
Safely down here with us, said Locke. We might be convinced to surrender them, but you'll have to help haul us up if you want them.
Now, on that subject, said the stranger, you and I have a sort of difference in outlook, like. Since I know you've got 'em now, I think it's easier to just chop you down and collect 'em at my ease.
Unless you're a much better rock climber than you look, said Jean. It's one hell of a climb down and back for the sake of our little purses. And they are little, said Locke. Our rock climbing purses, specially made not to weigh us down, hardly held anything.
I think we probably got different ideas of what anything is, and I wouldn't have to climb, said the stranger. There's easier ways down to that valley floor if you know where to go.
Don't be foolish, said Jean. These ropes are demi-silk.
It'll take you some time to cut through them. Longer than it will take for us to climb back up, surely.
Probably, said the man in the cloak. But I'm still up here if you do, ain't I? I can just crack you over the edge and make your skulls into soup bowls, like. See if I don't.
But if we stay down here, we'll die anyway. So we might as well come up and die fighting, said Locke.
Well, have it your way, sir. Whole conversation's getting sort of circular, if you don't mind me saying so. So I'm just going to start cutting rope now. Me, I'd stay put and go quiet, was I you.
Yeah, well, you're a miserable cur, shouted Locke. Any child of three could murder helpless men hanging over a cliff. Time was when a bandit would have the balls to fight us face to face and earn his pay.
What do I rightly look like, sir? An honest tradesman? Guild tats on my arms?
He knelt down and began to chop at something steadily with Jean's hatchet.
Splatting you against those rocks below seems a fine way of earning my pay. Even finer, if you're going to speak so unkind.
You're a wretch, cried Locke. A cringing dog, a scrub, damned not just for avarice but for cowardice. The gods spit on those without honour, you know. It'll be a cold hell and a dark one for you.
I'm chock full of honour, sir. Got lots of it. Keep it right here between my empty stomach and my puckered white ass, which you may kiss, by the way.
Fine, fine, said Locke. I merely wanted to see if you could be goaded to misjudgment. I applaud your restraint. But surely there's more profit to be had in hoisting us up and holding us for ransom.
We're important people, said Jean.
With rich, important friends. Why not just hold us prisoner and send a letter with a ransom demand? Well, said the man, for one thing, I can't read nor write.
We'd be happy to write the demand for you.
Can't rightly see how that'd work. You could just write anything you like, couldn't you? Ask for constables and soldiers instead of gold, if you take my meaning. I said I can't read, not that I got worm piss for brains.
Whoa, hold it, stop cutting.
Jean heaved himself up another foot and braced his rope within the descender to hold him.
Stop cutting! I have a serious question.
What's that, then?
Where the hell did you come from?
Roundabouts, here and there, by way of my mother's womb, original-like, said the man, who continued chopping.
No, I mean, do you always watch these cliffs for climbers? Seems bloody unlikely they'd be common enough to skulk in ambush for.
Oh, they isn't, sir. Ain't never seen any before you two. Was so curious I just had to come down and take a peek. And ain't I glad I did.
Chop, chop, chop.
No, mostly I hide in the woods. Sometimes the hills. Watch the roads.
All by yourself?
I'd be cutting you down faster if I wasn't by myself, wouldn't I?
So you watch the roads, looking to rob what? Carriages?
Mostly.
You have a bow or a crossbow?
Sadly, no. Think maybe I might buy a piece if I can get enough for your things.
You hide in the woods all by yourself and try to ambush carriages without a real weapon?
Well, said the man a bit hesitantly, has been a while since I got one. But today's my lucky day, ain't it?
I should say so. Crooked Warden, you must be the worst highwayman under the sun.
What did you say?
He said, said Locke, that in his highly educated opinion, you're the...
No, the other part.
He mentioned the Crooked Warden, said Locke. Does that mean something to you? We're members of the same fraternity, friend. The Benefactor, the Thief Watcher, the Nameless 13th, patron of you and I and all who take the twisty path through life. We're actually consecrated servants of the Crooked Warden. There's no need for animosity and no need for you to cut us down.
Oh, yes, there is, said the man vehemently. Now I'm definitely cutting you down.
What? Why?
Bloody fucking heretics, you are. There ain't no 13th. Ain't naught but the 12, that's truth. Yeah, I been to Verra a couple times, met up with lads and lasses from the cutting crews what tried to tell me about this 13th. I don't hold with it. Ain't right like I was raised. So down you go, boys.
The man began hacking at the demi-silk ropes with a vengeance.
Shit! Want to try and snag him in the belay lines?
Jean swung over beside Locke and spoke with soft urgency. Locke nodded. The two thieves took hold of their ends of their belay lines, stared upward, and at Jean's whispered signal, yanked them downward. It was hardly an efficient trap. The lines were slack and coiled up above the cliffs. Their tormentor looked down at his feet, hopped up and stepped away as 7 or 8 feet of each belay line slipped over the cliff's edge.
Ha! You'll have to get up earlier than that, gents, if you don't mind my saying so.
Whistling tunelessly, he vanished out of sight and continued chopping. A moment later he gave a cry of triumph, and Locke's coiled belay line flew over the edge of the cliff. Locke averted his face as the rope fell just past him. It was soon dangling in thin air from his waist belt, its frayed far end still too many feet above the ground for safety.
Shit, said Locke. Right, Jean, here's what we do. He should cut my main line next. Let's hook arms. I'll slide down your main line, not what's left of mine, to the bottom, and that should probably get us within 20 feet or so of the ground. If I haul up my belay line and knot that on the end of the other two, we can make it all the way down.
Depends on how quickly that asshole cuts. You think you can tie knots fast enough?
I think I've got no choice. My hands feel up to the task, at least. Even if I just get one line lashed, 20 feet's a happier fall than 80.
At that moment, there was a faint rumble of thunder overhead. Locke and Jean looked up at just the right moment to feel the first few drops of rain on their faces.
It's possible, said Locke, that this would be really fucking amusing right now, were it anyone but us down on these ropes.
At the moment, I think I'd take my chances with your pigeons if I could, said Jean. Damn, I'm sorry for leaving the wicked sisters up there, Locke.
Why in Venaportha's name would you have brought them down? There's nothing to apologize for.
Although, said Jean, maybe there is one other thing I could try. You carrying sleeve steel?
Yeah, but it's in my boot.
The rain was beating down fairly hard now, soaking through their tunics and wetting their lines. Their light dress and the stiff breeze made it seem colder than it really was.
Yourself?
Got mine right here.
Locke saw a flash of bright metal in Jean's right hand.
Yours balanced for throwing, Locke.
Shit, no. Sorry.
No worries. Hold it in reserve, then, and give us a good silent prayer.
Jean paused to pluck off his optics and tuck them into his tunic collar, then raised his voice.
Hey, sheep lover! A word, if you please! I sort of thought we was done talking,
came the man's voice from above the cliff's edge.
No doubt. I'll wager using so many words in so short a time makes your brain feel like a squeezed lemon, doesn't it? You wouldn't have the wit to find the fucking ground if I threw you out of a bloody window. Are you listening? You'd have to take your shoes and breeches off to count to 21. You'd have to look up to see the underside of cockroach shit.
Does it help, yelling at me like that? Seems like you should be praying to your useless 13th or something. But what would I know? I ain't one of you big-time Ferrari felon tossers or whatever, am I?
You want to know why you shouldn't kill us? You want to know why you shouldn't let us hit that valley floor?
Jean hollered at the top of his lungs while bracing his feet more firmly against the cliffside and pulling back his right arm. Thunder echoed overhead.
See this, you idiot!
See what I've got in my hands? Something you'll see only once in a lifetime. Something you'll never forget.
A few seconds later, the man's head and torso appeared over the edge of the cliff. Jean let out a cry as he flung his knife with all of his strength. The cry became triumphant as he saw the blurred shape of his weapon strike home in their tormentor's face, and changed yet again to a frustrated groan as he saw the knife bounce back and fall away into thin air. It had struck hilt first.
"Fucking rain!" yelled Jean.
The bandit was in serious pain, at least. He moaned and clutched his face, teetering forward. A nice hard smack in the eye? Jean fervently hoped so. Perhaps he still had a few seconds to try again.
"Locke, your knife, quickly!"
Locke was reaching into his right boot when the man thrust his arms out for balance, lost it, and toppled screaming over the edge of the cliff. He got one hand around Locke's main line a second later and fell directly into the crook of Locke's waist and rope, where they met at the iron descender on his belt. The shock knocked Locke's legs away from the cliff as it knocked the breath from his lungs, and for a second he and the bandit were in free fall, flailing and screaming in a tangle of arms and legs, with no proper pressure on the line in the descender. Straining himself to the utmost, Locke curled his left hand around the free side of the line and tugged hard, putting enough strain on the rope to snap them to a halt. They swung into the cliff face together, the bandit taking the brunt of the impact, and dangled there in a struggling mess of limbs while Locke fought to breathe and make sense of the world. The bandit kicked and screamed.
"Stop that, you fucking moron!"
They seemed to have fallen about 15 feet. Jean slipped rapidly down beside them, alighted on the cliff, and reached out with one hand to grab the bandit by the hair. With the hood thrown back, Locke could see that the fellow was grizzled like an underfed hound, perhaps 40, with long greasy hair and a grey beard as scrubby as the grass on the cliff's edge. His left eye was swelling shut.
"Stop kicking, you idiot! Hold still!" "Oh, gods, please don't drop me! Please don't kill me, sir!" "Why the fuck not?"
Locke groaned, dug his heels into the cliff, and managed to reach the edge of his right boot with his right hand. A moment later, he had his stiletto out at the bandit's throat, and the man's panicked kicking became a terrified quivering.
"See this?" Locke hissed.
The bandit nodded.
"This is a knife. They have these wherever the fuck you came from?"
The man nodded again.
"So you know I could just stick you right now and let you fall, right?" "Please, please don't!" "Shut up and listen. This single line that you and I are dangling from right now, single, solitary, alone, this wouldn't be the line you were just chopping at up there, would it?"
The man nodded vigorously, his good eye wide.
"Isn't that splendid? Well, if the shock of your fall didn't break it, we're probably safe for a little while longer."
White light flashed somewhere above them and thunder rolled, louder than before.
"Though I have been much more comfortable. So don't kick, don't flail, don't struggle, and don't do anything fucking stupid, savvy?" "Oh no, sir, oh please!" "Shut up already!"
Leocanto, said Jean. "I'm thinking this fellow deserves some flying lessons."
"I'm thinking the same thing," said Locke. "But thieves prosper, right, Jerome? Help me haul this stupid bastard back up there somehow."
"Oh, thank you.
"Know why I'm doing this, you witless woodland clown?"
"No, but I..."
"Shut it. What's your name?"
"Trav."
"Trav what?"
"Never had no afternamed, sir. Trav of Vosarmara is all."
"And you're a thief? A highwayman?"
Yes, I am."
"Nothing else? Do any honest work?"
No, not for some time now."
"Good.
Then we are brothers of a sort. Look, my smelly friend, the thing you have to understand is that there is a 13th. He does have a priesthood, and I'm one of his priests. Savvy?
If you say so.
No, shut up. I don't want you to agree with me. I want you to use your misplaced acorn of a brain before the squirrel comes looking for it again. I have a blade at your throat. We're 70 feet above the ground, it's pissing a nice hard rain, and you just tried to murder me. By all rights, I ought to give you a red smile from ear to ear and let you drop. Would you agree to that?
Oh, probably, sir. Gods, I'm sorry.
Hush now, sweet moron. So you'd admit that I must have a pretty powerful reason for not satisfying myself with your death?
I guess.
I'm a divine of the Crooked Warden, like I said, sworn to the service and the mandates of the god of our kind. Seems kind of a waste to spit in the face of the god that looks out for you and yours, doesn't it? Especially since I'm not so sure I've been doing right by him recently. I should kill you. Instead, I'm going to try and save your life. All I want you to do is think about this. Do I still seem like a heretic to you?
Oh, God, sir, I can't think straight.
Well, nothing unusual there, I'd wager. Remember what I said. Don't flail, don't kick, don't scream. And if you try to fight, even the tiniest bit, our arrangement's off. Wrap your arms around my chest and shut up. We're a good long way from sitting pretty. 2. At Locke's urging, Jean went up first, hand over hand on the slick cliff face at about half his usual speed. Up top, he rapidly unknotted his own belay line from his belt and passed it down to Locke and his shaken passenger. Next, he took his harness off and slid his main line along the cliff edge until it too was beside the dangling men. They certainly didn't look comfortable, but with all three good lines in their reach, they were at least a bit safer. Jean found his frock coat on the ground and threw it on, grateful for the added coverage even if it was as sopping wet as the rest of him was. He thought quickly. Trav seemed a fairly meatless fellow, and Locke was lightly built. Surely they were no more than 300 pounds together. Jean was sure he could hoist nearly as much to his chest, perhaps even above his head, but in the rain, with so much at stake? His thoughts turned to the carriage, about a quarter mile distant through the woods. A horse would be a vast improvement on even a strong man, but the time it would require, and the trouble inherent in unhooking, calming, and leading a beast whose master had been clubbed unconscious... Fuck it, he said, and went back to the cliff's edge. Leocanto! Still here, as you might have guessed. Can the two of you make one of my ropes good and fast to your belt? There was a brief muttered conversation between Locke and Trav. We'll manage, Locke yelled. What do you have in mind? Have the idiot hold tight to you. Brace your arms and legs against the cliff once you've lashed yourselves to one of my lines. I'll start hauling on it with all I've got, but I'm sure your assistance won't hurt. Right. You heard the man, Trav. Let's tie a knot. Mind where you put your hands. When Locke looked up and gave Jean their private hand signal for proceed, Jean nodded. The secured rope was Jean's former belay line. He seized the working end just before the coil that lay on the wet ground and frowned. The sludge underfoot would make things even more interesting than they already were, but there was nothing else for it. He formed a bite in the rope, stepped into it, and let it slide tight around his waist. He then leaned back, away from the cliff, with one hand on the rope before him and one hand behind, and cleared his throat. "Tired of dangling? Or shall I let you have a few more minutes down there?" "Jerome,
if I have to cradle Trav here for 1 second longer than I absolutely must, I'm going to...
Climb away, then.
Jean dug his heels in, allowed himself to lean even farther back, and began to strain at the rope. Gods damn it, he was a powerful man, unusually strong, but why did moments always come along to remind him that he could be even stronger? He'd been slacking, no other word for it. He should find some crates, fill them with rocks, and heave them up a few dozen times a day, as he had in his youth. Damn, would the rope ever move? There. At last, after a long, uncomfortable interval of motionless heaving in the rain, Jean took a slow step back, and then another, and another. Haltingly, with an itching fire steadily rising in the muscles of his thighs, he did his best impression of a plough horse, pushing deep furrows into the gritty grey mud. Finally, a pair of hands appeared at the edge of the cliff, and in a torrent of shouts and curses, Trav hoisted himself up over the top and rolled onto his back, gasping. Immediately, the strain on Jean slackened. He maintained his previous level of effort, and just a moment later, Locke popped over the edge. He crawled to his feet, stepped over beside Trav, and kicked the would-be bandit in the stomach.
You fucking jackass! Of all the stupid damn... How difficult would it have been to say, I'll lower a rope, tie your purses onto it and send them up, or I won't let you back up. You don't tell your bloody victims you're just going to kill them outright. You come on reasonable first, and when you have the money, you run. Oh. Ow! Gods, please! Ow! You said you wouldn't kill me! And I meant it. I'm not going to kill you, you cabbage-brained twit. I'm just going to kick you until it stops feeling good. Ow! Ah! Please! Ow! I have to say, it's still pretty fascinating. Aya! Ow! Still enjoying myself. Oof! Ah!
Locke finally ceased pummeling the unfortunate Ferrari, unbuckled his harness belt, and dropped it in the mud. Jean, breathing heavily, came up beside him and handed him his soaked coat. Thank you, Jerome. Having his coat back, sopping or no, seemed to salve some of Locke's wounded dignity.
As for you, Trav? Travavo Salmara, you said? Yes! Oh, please, don't kick me again!
Look here, Trav. Here's what you're going to do. First, tell no one about this. Second, don't fucking go anywhere near Tal Verar. Got it?
Wasn't planning to, sir.
Good. Here. Locke reached down into his left boot and drew out a very slender purse. He tossed it down beside Trav, where it landed with a jingling plop.
Should be 10 Valani in there, a healthy bit of silver. And you can...
Wait a minute. Are you absolutely sure our driver's still alive?
Oh, gods, yes. Honest truth, Master Leo Canto, sir. He was breathing and moaning after I thumped him. He surely was.
So much the better for you, then. You can have the silver in that purse. When Jerome and I have left, you can come back and take whatever we leave. My vest and some of this rope, for sure. And listen to me very carefully. I saved your life today when I could have killed you in a heartbeat. Sound about right to you?
Yes, yes you did, and I'm so very...
Yes, shut up. Someday, Trav of Vo Sarmara, I may find myself back in these parts, and I may need something. Information, a guide, a bodyguard... 13 help me if it's you I have to turn to, but if anyone ever comes to you and whispers the name of Leocanto Costa, you jump at their word. You hear?
Yes.
Your oath before the gods?
Upon my lips and upon my heart, before the gods, or strike me dead and find me wanton on the scales of the Lady of the Long Silence.
Good enough. Remember... Now fuck off in the direction of your choice, so long as it isn't back toward our carriage. Jean and Locke watched him scamper away for a minute or two, until his cloaked figure had faded from view behind the shifting grey curtains of the downpour.
"Well," said Jean, "I think that's enough practice for one day, don't you?"
"Absolutely. The actual Sinspire job will be a bloody ballroom dance compared to this. What say we just grab the two spare coils of rope and make for the carriage? Let Trav spend the rest of the afternoon out here untying knots."
"A lovely plan."
Jean inspected his wicked sisters, recovered from the edge of the cliff, and gave them a possessive pat on their blades before slipping them into his coat pocket.
"There, darlings. That ass might have dulled you a bit, but I'll soon have you sharpened up again."
"I hardly credit it," said Locke. "Nearly murdered by some half-wit country mudsucker. You know, I do believe that's the first time since Velvirazzo that anyone's actually tried to kill either of us."
"Seems about right. 18 months.
Jean slipped one wet coil of rope around his shoulder and passed the other to Locke. Together they turned and began to trudge back through the forest.
"Nice to know that some things never really change, isn't it?"
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.